top stories this hour. Russia says the first day of its military operation in Ukraine was successfully completed. Now Moscow says it is willing to negotiate the terms of surrender with Kiev. The U.S. targets Russia with a wave of sanctions over its attack against Ukraine. The European Union, Canada, and Britain also announced measures against Moscow. Also, Iran's president tells his Russian counterpart that NATO's eastward expansion is a serious threat to the stability and security of independent countries. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour. The Russian military says it has successfully reached the goals set out for the first day of operations against Ukraine. The military says it has eliminated Ukraine's air defenses and now controls the skies over the country. It says the air raids are not targeting cities and pose no threat to civilians. Russian paratroopers are said to have captured an airfield near the capital, Kiev. Moscow says it is willing to negotiate the terms of surrender with Kiev. A Kremlin spokesman says President Vladimir Putin has expressed his preparedness to engage his Ukrainian counterpart in discussions with a focus on obtaining a guarantee of neutral status and the promise of no weapons on his territory. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he is not afraid of talking about neutrality as his request for NATO accession went unanswered by 27 European leaders.
Today I've asked 27 European leaders whether Ukraine will be in NATO. I've asked directly. Everyone is afraid. No one answers. But we are not afraid. We're not afraid of anything. We're not afraid to defend our country. We're not afraid of Russia. We're not afraid to talk to Russia. We're not afraid to talk about anything, about security guarantees for our country. We're not afraid about talking about neutrality. We are not NATO members at the moment, but what guarantees will we get? And most importantly, which countries will give us those guarantees?
Zelensky says he remains in the capital, although he is marked as, quote, target number one by the enemy. The Ukrainian leader says 137 Ukrainians died on the first day of the fighting, with more than 300 others being injured. The UN Refugee Agency says around 100,000 people have been internally displaced, while several thousand more have left Ukraine. Kiev has declared martial law after reporting over 200 attacks from the Russian side. Ukraine says it has killed 50 Russian troops and shot down 6 Russian aircraft, a claim that has not been verified. Western countries are taking punitive measures against Russia by imposing a raft of sanctions over its military actions in Ukraine. The United States targeted 5 major Russian banks, aimed at preventing them from doing business in major currencies. Washington also imposed sanctions on members of the Russian elite and their families, warning that more actions could follow. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau also announced sanctions against some 60 individuals and entities. French President Emmanuel Macron said sanctions against Moscow would be proportionate to what he called the level of its aggression. Australia blacklisted several Russian citizens and lawmakers. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson unveiled a massive package of economic sanctions against Moscow over its anti-Kiev move.
Today, in concert with our allies, we will agree a massive package of economic sanctions designed in time to hobble the Russian economy. And to that end, we must also collectively cease the dependence on Russian oil and gas that for too long has given Putin his grip on Western politics. Not in the infamous phrase, some faraway country.
Johnson accused Moscow of attacking Ukraine without any provocation or credible justification. He said the UK will work with Ukraine and other allies to counter Russia. The president of the European Commission has made similar remarks, saying the bloc will impose massive sanctions on Russia. With the conflict raging between Russia and Ukraine, the West has been quick to levy sanctions and other penalties on Moscow, but eyebrows have been raised after Britain's political establishment publicly targeted Russia's flagship media outlet in the country. There are now concerns over whether the industry regulator will follow existing media law or bow to political pressure. Amina Taylor has more.
As the crisis escalates between Russia and Ukraine, it's the role of the media that's become increasingly crucial. In Britain's parliament, the leader of the opposition Labour Party waded into the discussion with a controversial position.
Russia today is his personal propaganda tool.
Yeah.
I can see no reason why it should be allowed to continue to broadcast in this country. So will the Prime Minister now ask Ofcom to review its licence?
Mr Speaker, I believe that my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, has already asked Ofcom to review that matter.
It's not the first time RT has been targeted, but long gone are the days of Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn appearing on the channel. Starmer is keen to stake his anti-Russian credentials.
Russia and the West are both acutely aware that the media battle is as important as any armed conflict. And by attempting to silence Russian media here in the United Kingdom, the British establishment is simply continuing a long-held tradition of censorship.
Political observers disagree with Starmer's stance.
It's totalitarian surveillance capitalism, essentially, which is continuing its ugly march through the West. I mean, where we actually prided ourselves in not being so censored, we're now at the stage where we're controlling media. At that point, of course, I know Press TV were victims of exactly this. There have been many people across social media who are constantly being censored. And I think it's a very dangerous development. And when it's normalized to the extent where, you know, the major party leaders, the prime minister, are all acting as if it's a perfectly normal thing to do, it's a very dangerous and dark day for democracy.
Though it's not publicly commented on whether there will be a probe, Ofcom's impartiality has already come under scrutiny, and observers are urging caution and for the organisation to abide by media rules, not political pressure.
It is always good to hear the other side of an argument anyway, and an alternative narrative, so you can see and make a balanced judgment of what is going on. Because we know from the Iraq war and the propaganda about WMD that our own government doesn't necessarily tell the truth when it goes to broadcast either. These are very troubled times, and the last thing we need is censorship of our television viewing.
As calls ring out for calm heads and a de-escalation to prevail in the current crisis, media observers hope the people at home and abroad can have a plurality of media voices, this to help shape their views. Amina Taylor, London.
Investigative journalist and political commentator Tony Gosling says imposing sanctions is all the US and the UK can do to Russia, and they will never succeed in pushing Moscow out of the global economy.
Well, we had several hours of discussion and debate in the British Houses of Parliament at the beginning of the week about sanctions, even though this had never happened then. It seems it's sanctions week against Russia. And I was amazed to see, as part of his speech, Boris Johnson today finished up by saying the UK will push Russia out of the global economy. Well, I don't know how many people are supposed to believe that around the world, whether the UK or even the US, with the UK, have got the ability to push Russia out of the global economy. I mean, these sorts of threats have been around for many years, and the actual fact of the matter is that the British economy and the American economy are falling apart at the seams, and the real economy in the world are the more stable countries such as China and Russia. These are the real economic powerhouses of the planet. And, this is really just a message trying to encourage his own supporters and the Americans, and it's bluster, basically. So there's no way that the British are ever going to push Russia out of the global economy, no more than they can push China out of the global economy. But this is really all they can do.
Journalist and political commentator Daniel Lazar believes the West's hostile policies and aggressive actions left Russia with no other choice but to launch a military operation in Ukraine. Let's take a listen.
I don't want to defend Russia's action. I mean, war is bad, an aggressive war is very bad, should oppose this completely. But nonetheless, the U.S. policy of hostility really had sort of placed Russia under siege. And the Biden administration's talk about massive sanctions being imposed on Russia left Putin concluding that he had nothing to lose, that whatever happened, the U.S. is going to impose sanctions. Therefore, he might as well take action to neutralize the Ukrainian military threat. And that's probably how we saw it. So I think that at the bottom of this is the very aggressive actions by the U.S. And its NATO allies.
Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, for the latest on Russia's military operation in Ukraine. He says some Western media and politicians are blaming the West's dismissal of Moscow's security concerns for the current situation.
We're hearing now, like even on the Western media, when you have a big situation like this, people start apportioning blame. And actually, they apportion blame to both sides. So we're actually hearing more and more, like former Western ambassadors to Russia and so on, saying that, look, the West should have taken into account Russia's legitimate security concerns more seriously. That all of these negotiations and all of these talks, I mean, Stoltenberg mentioned we've been reaching out to Russia for weeks and weeks, but actually nothing meaningful, obviously, was said to Vladimir Putin in Moscow. And therefore, it was seemed to be impossible to de-escalate the situation, because the rhetoric coming from NATO and the European Union, which is driven, of course, by the United States, has always been about NATO expansion, about the possibility at some point that Ukraine can join NATO. And this was a red line for Russia.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has slammed NATO's eastward expansion, describing the approach as provocative. Raisi says NATO expansion is a serious threat to stability and security of independent countries in different regions. The Iranian president expressed hope that what is happening at the moment would end in favor of nations in the region. He made the comments in a telephone conversation with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. For his part, Putin said the current situation is a legitimate response to decades of breaches of security treaties by the West and its efforts to undermine his country's security. Iran's top security official says the Western parties engaged in the Vienna talks need to make political decisions to resolve the key issues. In a tweet post, Ali Shamkhani said the final conclusion will not be reached without resolving the remaining crucial issues. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says there has been considerable progress in the talks thanks to Iran's initiative, and reaching a good deal is on the horizon. Separately, Iran's top negotiator in Vienna said the European sides need to make certain decisions in order for the discussions to produce the desired result. Ali Bogheri-Kani, in a tweet, called on the Europeans to adopt a balanced approach. Negotiating teams continue their discussions in the Austrian capital to reach a final agreement. Iran has said time and again that it will not compromise on the rights and interests of its people. Beirut reacting to Israel's latest violation of the Lebanese airspace. President Michel Aoun condemns the regime's quote repeated violations of Lebanon's sovereignty, urging the United Nations to pressure Tel Aviv to end such aggressions. He made the remarks during a farewell meeting with the outgoing head of the United Nations interim force in Lebanon. Aoun called for the implementation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701, which ended Israel's 33-day war on Lebanon in 2006. The Lebanese president urged respect for his country's sovereignty. Israel repeatedly conducts airstrikes on targets in Syria through the Lebanese airspace. On Thursday, three Syrian soldiers were killed in an air raid near the capital, Damascus. Afghans have taken to the streets of capital Kabul to voice their anger at a U.S. decision to give some parts of the Afghan central bank's frozen assets in Washington to the victims of the 9/11 attack. Rahmatullah Baghwan reports from the Afghan capital, Kabul.
Hundreds of Afghan youths and sportsmen rallied against the U.S. in Kabul. The rally is part of massive anti-U.S. sentiments underway in the country over the recent decision by the American president to give some parts of the Afghans' national assets to the victims of the 9/11 attacks. We want all of our money. Biden is a thief. Death to America. These are the slogans that the protesters chanted as they were holding anti-U.S. placards.
These sportsmen call on the U.S. to reverse its decision and free all of their money. They say freezing Afghanistan's assets has harmed all aspects of the Afghan society.
We have gathered here on behalf of all Afghan youths and sportsmen to condemn the U.S. president's decision to give half of our frozen assets to Americans. Of course, this decision is crazy and unjust. The U.S.'s move has affected all Afghans' lives. Our athletes and sportsmen are quitting their sports due to economic difficulties.
The angry protesters also say that if the U.S. does not reverse its unjust and immoral decision, their protests will escalate.
The U.S. considers itself as one of the richest countries, but now it's shamelessly stealing from the poorest people of the world. We call on the U.S. to free all of our frozen assets and stop punishing and torturing Afghans. Our demonstrations will continue until we reach our rights.
Staging in front of the U.N. office in Kabul, the protesters called on the UN and World Bank donors not to stay silent against the U.S. operations and stay by Afghans' side.
Afghans were not involved in 9/11 attack. This is crystal clear to the world countries. So why should the U.S. seek revenge from us? In addition, today Afghans are dealing with many economic and health crises. We urge the international community to make the U.S. reconsider its decision and let the flow of aid to our vulnerable people.
Last week, the U.S. president signed an order allowing half of $7 billion in Afghan frozen assets to be given to 9/11 victims. The move has sparked outrage in Afghanistan and was massively denounced. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korea has hit a peak of more than 170,000 new daily cases, an increase of 60,000 per day this week as the Omicron variant of COVID-19 spreads. The surge jeopardizes plans to open the economy and ease restrictions. With school terms set to begin next week, concern grows over whether classes should be online or in person and whether vaccines should be mandated. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
It is time to bury the hatchet and make up for the lost time by getting together to form a regional body and keep out all outsiders, especially the U.S. and Israeli regime, in the interest of peace, security, and stability of the Persian Gulf, says Kahan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Need for Persian Gulf States to Solidify Ties. Stay tuned for more. The Iranian president who visited Qatar for attending the summit of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum, that is GECF, noted the inadequate relations amongst the littoral states and called for enhancement of ties in all fields. Dr. Sayed Ibrahim Raisi, in his joint press conference with Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani in Doha, after holding fruitful talks with his host, said, "The level of current cooperation among regional states is not commensurate with the huge capacities available, and the Islamic Republic of Iran seeks to help strengthen and promote regional relations within the framework of its policy to boost ties with neighbors." He added, Iran seeks a change in regional relations to boost interaction, cooperation, and convergence, noting, the Islamic Republic of Iran has proved that it always stands by the interests of independent countries and nations. This is not a new stance by Tehran, which ever since the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in 1979 has stressed the Islamic unity and regional solidarity, and time and again has offered to share its spectacular achievements in all fields with the Arab states of the Persian Gulf. Unfortunately, because of U.S. meddling and the lack of confidence of the rulers of the littoral states in their own selves, mainly due to the fact they are hereditary and not elected by the people they govern, an era of mistrust had developed, to the detriment of peace, security, and stability of the region. The first and foremost enemy of cooperation and coordination was Saddam of the tyrannical Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad, who, in addition to his frequent bouts of massacre of the Iraqi people, imposed the destructive 8-year war on Iran on the orders of the United States in a vain bid to create bad blood between Arabs and Iranians. As a result, the six states on the southern shores of the strategic waterway that accounts for almost 40% of oil shipments to the world set up the so-called Persian Gulf Cooperative Council, that is PGCC, by excluding the two major powers, Iran and Iraq, but soon became embroiled in their own petty differences, as was evident by the boycott of Qatar by Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Bahrain, and war they imposed on Yemen. But soon they realized how badly they had blundered, and now, after sending feelers of friendship to Iran, have become to mend fences with fellow PGCC member Qatar, whom they had unsuccessfully tried to isolate for its refusal to break diplomatic ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Yet Iran, due to its Islamic spirit and sense of brotherhood, has always extended the olive branch to those in the region which had unnecessarily tried to adopt a hostile attitude towards it on the instigations of the Americans and the Zionists. In line with its principal policy of regional solidarity, Tehran is determined to end the sway of the CENTCOM terrorists over the region and looks forward to sound and healthy cooperation with all states of the Persian Gulf. An important point to note is that, except for the Regional Organization for the Protection of the Marine Environment, ROPME, that was founded in 1970s and includes all 8 Persian Gulf states, including Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, the UAE, Kuwait, and Oman, there is no other body binding these littoral states together. Thus, it is time to bury the hatchet and make up for the lost time by getting together to form a regional body and keep out all outsiders, especially the United States and the Zionist regime, in the interest of peace, security, and stability of the Persian Gulf. The potential for cooperation is vast, and the moment these countries decide to promote ties in all fields, it will be beneficial for the whole region in view of the fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran possesses all that the other countries require.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. As always, I have the honor and pleasure of being joined by my darling sister and special guest, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. How are you, my dear?
I'm very good, thank you. So, I don't know which part of the world you guys are on in... So on the previous episode of Muslim Lady, for those who've just joined us or those who've been with us through this journey, we were talking about the expectations of society the expectation society has of Muslim women. When we talk about society in general, the issue of double standards inevitably is raised. And that whether or not society is fair and just towards regarding its expectations from men and women. And I think that's evident in all societies, whether Muslim or not.
But something that is good these days is that people are becoming less hypocrite.
Definitely.
We had two problems. Double standards, maybe 2 decades ago, 1 decade ago. People had these two double standards. They didn't know what to do. Like they grabbed some part from this standard, some part from this standard. As some people call it, or camel, cow, and tiger. Okay. That, you know, they say that these days our personalities and our identities are a combination of so many different things that have come together, right? So you can imagine an animal that has the head of a cow, that has wings of a bird, that has like the body of a horse and the legs of an ostrich, something like that. And I was actually thinking about it. I think it's true. Like, you know, us women, 50 years ago, you either stayed at home and you wore a complete hijab when you went out and you had your man as everything, your source of support economically. Or it was the case that you believed in no hijab. You were Western.
Which society are we talking about here?
I'm talking, for example, about the society of Iran.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Or you didn't believe in any hijab. Or even I'm talking about Egypt. I'm talking about Syria. I'm talking about Lebanon, right? Back then, we had Islamic values, traditional Islamic values, and you had modern reformist ideas where you believed, yeah, well, you know, there's no place in the Quran talks about hijab. Actually, hijab is a patriarchal thing to limit women, and that if you segregate men and women from each other in the society, women will greatly be damaged because they will not have any experience of how to react with the men, and they're not going to be successful life. So there should be integration of men and women, no hijab, women going to university, studying everything.
I'm so confused as to how can someone interpret hijab as a patriarchy thing.
Nowadays, if I tell you why women wear hijab, you say, because I'm a human being. I want a man to see my inner human beauties rather than my outer
curves, you know, and charms.
Exactly.
And this is all what I've always understood from hijab.
Yeah, exactly. This is what we have been learning in the past decade. This is how we grew up.
Yeah.
But 30, 40 years ago, when the concept of hijab was raised, women would not say that. Women were not that educated. Women did not really. A lot of men, even until 60, 70 years ago, believed that the human status of men and women is not the same, is not equal. Mm-hmm. Now we take it for granted that the value in human status, that women are as human as a man, that women are as valuable as a man. Can you believe that less than a century ago, some men used to think that women are not in the same value status or human status as women? Now you take it for granted. And back then, even I'm talking about 50 years ago, that hijab was like, this woman, I am the man of this woman, and this woman has to stay in the house, and she's my property. She's my woman. She's my weak. I own everything about her.
We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
I didn't grow up in a non-Islamic country, right? And
you didn't grow in a non-Islamic country?
No, I grew up in a non-Islamic country, okay. Right? And maybe 50-60% of my ethnic background is not Middle Eastern, not Muslim. And so when you say these things, that there was a time, or maybe still is in certain societies, that the woman was considered as a man's property, I cannot place it in any culture that I associated myself with, right? Islam came to say that, look, you see this woman? She's an individual creature of creation of God on her own. She's valued, she's loved, she's respected, she's got rights. She's your equal in life and death. You're maybe a little stronger than her, but your souls are the same, and that's what God judges you on. Stop acting like you own her. Here is Islam to liberate women and give them back their God-given rights and empower them.
All these are thoughts that we have been learning after the Islamic Revolution.
And then 1,400 years later, the exact opposite is happening exactly. In the name of Islam. And exactly. I'm like, ugh, the irony. Exactly. You know what I mean?
This is exactly true. Prior to the Islamic Revolution, and I'm not just talking about an Iranian thing. You know, in all these Muslim countries, unfortunately, people were divided into different groups. But considering the bigger picture, you were either traditional Muslim, mm-hmm. which where you believe that you only have to stick to the wordings of the Quran and the Rivayat, the mm-hmm. narrations, or you were a reformist, right? That where you believe that, you know, so many things have to change and so many incorrect, false information was added to the interpretation of the Quran and the Rivayat by yeah. people who brought in their background knowledge to understand and to analyze the meaning of the Quran and the Rivayat, mm-hmm. right? So you have people like Nasser Abu Zayd, who was a reformist, or you have people like Muhammad Abdo, or you have people like Fatima Mernissi. A lot of these people are in Egypt, mm-hmm. these reformists who think that the Quran came to bring a revolution to the lives of men and women. Mm. And the prophet started a revolution, but because he passed away and, you know, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, people deviated his path. We believe that, yes, the prophet came and Thaqifa happened. But then after the prophet, أَيْنَ السَّبَبُ الْمُتَّسَلُ بَيْنَ الْأَرْضِ وَالسَّمَاءِ, we have the imams. Where is the chain that connects the heaven with the earth?
Yeah, all of this could have been avoided.
Yeah, but anyhow, let's look at the reality.
Yeah,
we're not
it is what it is.
Utopia, right? So in reality, we do have the link to the heavens, to the sky, mm-hmm. to the revelation, to wahy, which are the imams of our time.
Yeah.
Of each time. When Imam Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala farjahu sharif, he reappears, the religion has been changed so much, and there is so much understanding, different understanding of religion, that when he comes and he brings the real Islam,
you're like, oh my God, it's a new religion.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
What have you been following all these years?
Exactly. The Prophet says in a hadith that I am so proud of my followers that they,
during the ends of time.
Exactly. Yeah. That they haven't seen me, but they believe in me and they follow in my footsteps. So they're
at least they try,
At least they try.
Even though the footsteps of Rasulullah and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam have been blurred much through
exactly.
the years. We try to
follow them. But then this, again, here, the double standards, I'm just saying that what goes on in history, everything that is happening throughout the years, we are human beings and we're mortal creatures, right? We are influenced by our surroundings. We are influenced by, the doctrines that is going on around us.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
After the Islamic Revolution, the leaders of the Islamic Revolution, like Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah Alayhi, and Ayatollah Khamenei, they have tried to stick to the teachings of Shiism, and they've really tried to bring up what the teachings of Islam is with regards to women.
Exactly. And, right. They talk about that so much, I wouldn't be surprised if certain backwards, close-minded Muslim individuals would label these people as feminists.
Exactly.
Or Islamic feminism.
Exactly.
What they're doing is just Islamic. You really don't need to put any label on them.
Exactly.
But what they say has been so neglected, and it's turned so rare that you feel like, oh, they're just making this stuff up. you know? And it's sometimes, sadly, unfortunately, tragically, so very much in contradiction with what many Muslim societies believe regarding women, as far as Islam is concerned, that, you know, it seems far-fetched. And they feel like he's trying to use women as a tool, as a political tool. But the man was just saying, look, maybe pick up a book or two and know that, yeah, this is what your religion is saying about you. Stop being the victim and allowing other people to victimize you.
Exactly. Going to the words of Ayatollah Khamenei, mm-hmm. because some researchers have collected his words on women and family, and it has been compiled into 6-7 volumes of books, mm-hmm. right? So I was just going through his beliefs, the words of Ayatollah Khamenei regarding women. From what he was saying and also from my own analytics, I tried to come up with what, you know, as a Muslim woman, what do I think the society, the Muslim society or, you know, the Muslim crowd expect from a Muslim woman? And the first thing that came to my mind was, what do you think? This is something that is shared between men and women. Because you remember in the very beginning you said, it's really interesting to talk about this topic, but then if you're expecting so much from a woman and then you're just excluding the man from this expectation, it's really not unfair. It's really unfair.
So this is a common expectation.
Exactly.
I don't know, be a good Muslim.
Be a good Muslim. How? This is something that you could see in Sardar Soleimani. Evident, vivid quality you saw in him. Sincerity. I didn't know Sardar Soleimani much. But when I heard the news of his martyrdom, my whole heart ached.
Exactly. It was like losing a father.
Everyone, religious and non-religious, government, pro-government and anti-government, they all wept for him.
The branch we've reached at this point has been that the society and women and men alike have deviated a lot from how a Muslim woman should be. And we've lost our sense of identity along the way. And along came the Islamic Revolution and redefined these lines and these roles for women and for the society to understand and accept a lot. But then again, it's a work in progress and it's not easy. And more on that on future episodes of Muslim Lady. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammad Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammad Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Protests in the United States are to follow Canadian truckers' demonstration against pandemic restrictions. We have prepared for you an article written by staff writers of the Associated Press news agency. The piece is titled U.S. National Guard Troops to be Deployed in D.C. as Trucker Convoy Protests Loom. The Pentagon is expected to approve the deployment of 700 to 800 unarmed National Guard troops to the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., a U.S. official said on Tuesday, 22nd of February, in the face of trucker convoys that are planning protests against pandemic restrictions beginning next week. The District of Columbia government and the U.S. Capitol Police are requesting the National Guard assistance. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said the troops would be used largely to help control traffic and are expected to come from the district's National Guard and three states. Modeled after recent trucker protests in Canada, separate truck convoys have been planned through online forums with names like the People's Convoy and the American Truckers Freedom Fund, all with different starting points, departure dates, and routes. Some are scheduled to arrive in time for Joe Biden's State of the Union address next Tuesday, 1st of March, though others may arrive afterward. John Kirby, the Pentagon press secretary, said the D.C. government and Capitol Police had requested National Guard personnel to provide support at traffic control points in and around the district and stand ready in case of possible disruption at key traffic arteries. John Kirby said no formal decision on the request had been made as yet. The convoys followed the recent Canadian truckers' protest that shut down the busiest U.S.-Canadian border crossing and besieged the streets of the capital, Ottawa, for weeks to protest government pandemic restrictions. The multiple blockades were broken up by police last week, with more than 100 arrests being made. It remains to be seen if any of the U.S. convoys would seek to actively shut down Washington's streets, the way their Canadian counterparts did in Ottawa. Some convoy organizers have spoken of plans to briefly roll through the city, then focus on shutting down the Beltway, which encircles Washington, D.C. A statement from the People's Convoy specifically says the trucks will not be going into D.C. proper. That convoy is planning to embark on Thursday, 24th of February, from Southern California and arrive in Washington, D.C. around 5th of March. The U.S. convoys seek an immediate lifting of what they say are heavy-handed government pandemic restrictions, such as mask mandates and vaccine requirements. The American Truckers Freedom Fund website says the group is protesting the unscientific, unconstitutional overreach of the federal government. Vaccines have proven highly effective at preventing COVID-19 infections, especially serious illness and death, and high-quality face masks offer strong protection against spreading or contracting the disease. Public sentiment, especially among conservatives, has been shifting against government mandates as the pandemic heads into its third year. The websites organizing the American trucker convoys directly reference the inspiration of the Canadian movement. A statement on the People's Convoy website pays homage to what they call our brave and courageous neighbors to the north, our Canadian brothers and sisters who led the charge. Robert Conti, chief of the Metropolitan Police in Washington, D.C., said recently that his department was closely monitoring the shifting information and would be devoting additional police hours in a rolling state of heightened alert over the next few weeks. Robert Conti and Mayor Muriel Bowser memorably predicted unrest several days before the 6th of January 2021 insurrection at the Capitol building. They warned residents to stay indoors and called for additional resources, but the Capitol Police and the National Guard were still caught unprepared when crowds of Donald Trump supporters overran the building, resulting in several deaths and numerous injuries. Lingering memories of the debacle have fueled a heightened sense of anxiety and speculation over the coming convoys. But Mayor Muriel Bowser said she wasn't yet warning residents to avoid the Capitol area or the National Mall. Muriel Bowser said, "We're not at a point to give specific instructions to residents just yet, but we will." Meanwhile, Canada's Parliament has approved Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's controversial decision to invoke rarely used emergency powers to end trucker-led anti-vaccine protests that have for weeks been held in Canada's capital city of Ottawa. The approval came on Monday night after 185 votes were polled in favour and 151 against the move in the Parliament, as the government received support from left-leaning New Democrats. Justin Trudeau invoked the Emergencies Act recently in a bid to quell anti-vaccine trucker protests. The unprecedented move came as thousands of protesters in trucks and other vehicles blocked the streets of Ottawa as well as two border crossings to vent their frustration over the COVID-19 vaccine mandates. The measures were decried by some opposition politicians as unnecessary and an abuse of power. Under the ordinance, the Canadian police would be granted additional powers to detain demonstrators and seize their trucks in order to clear blockades as well as banning the funding of protests. The so-called Freedom Convoy protests started with cross-border truckers protesting against the COVID-19 vaccinate or quarantine mandate, but later broadened to include people opposing all coronavirus health measures announced by the Trudeau government. Earlier on Monday, 21st of February, Justin Trudeau said his government still needed temporary emergency powers, citing real concerns about threats in the upcoming days. Trudeau told reporters, "This state emergency is not over. There continue to be real concerns about the coming days." Canadian police made 191 arrests and towed 79 vehicles during a three-day operation to clear protesters from downtown Ottawa. The operation ended on Sunday, 20th of February. The plan has drawn widespread condemnation from Canadians, including the Premier in Quebec, François Legault, who said Justin Trudeau's announcement risked putting oil under fire. Some members of the official opposition Conservative Party slammed Justin Trudeau for abusing his powers, with legislator Dean Allison denouncing what he called authoritarian military-style measures against the demonstrators. Green Party member Mike Morris, who voted against the ordinance, also criticised invoking the act as an inappropriate response to a failure in policing. He said, as many other parliamentarians have shared, the use of the Emergencies Act sets a worrying precedent for future protests. The Emergencies Act must now be debated by the Canadian Senate. The trucker-led demonstrations in Canada have been replicated in France, Australia and New Zealand in recent weeks, with truck drivers mulling similar rallies.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.